Locked in the bunker, shadows shake. One man clapping secrets awake. Board games living, dice they break. Echoes pounding, hearts they quake. In your bunker, board games rolling. One man clapping, stories growing. Hard rock thunder, speakers blowing. Clapping loud, the unknown.
Welcome to the sound of one man clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker. It is Sunday morning, it's pouring rain, and it's a good day to sit in a windowless room, sharing my thoughts with my nearest and dearest, and that is you. After a week off to take the fucks away, I am back in the chair. Today, we're going to go through all the games that were. I'll share everything that's coming in with incoming, 4 exclamation marks, and I'll take you through what's got my attention in crowdfunding. I then have a spectacular chat with the singular Jamie Stegmaier about his very own origin story. Saddle up, OMC crew. On with the show. Well, it's been a couple of weeks. I did take a week off, as I mentioned. The Fox and I went away. We went down to this amazing glamping space down in sort of the Southern Highlands in New South Wales. It is spectacularly gorgeous. We had 3 days with no children. We ate food cooked on open flame. We drank red wine. We did weird and wonderful adult things that you can't do when you live in a house full of children. And we played board games. Of course we played board games. We played two-player games. Yes, we did. And it was lovely. And it's great to be back. Now we're in the home stretch out to Christmas. It's like 5-6 weeks till the fat man cometh. I've been a very, very good ham as this year. And I've put a very special list in. And I am hoping that all the legwork I've done all year pays off in spades. But watch this space. We will see. But without further ado, the games that were. I played a number of games in the last couple of weeks of Hot Streak. Hot Streak's a new hotness. That was a really lame bit of dialogue, but it is. It's a new hotness. And it's such the new hotness that I actually couldn't wait for it to be released in Australia. So I hopped on Amazon US and I got a copy shipped over from the US because it just looked like so many bags of fun. Oh, spoiler alert, Hot Streak is freaking glorious. So in Hot Streak, you've got this box. And you kind of pull this, it's like a blind on a window. You go, zzz, you pull it out one side, and it's the racetrack. And it's got 4 lanes on it. And inside the box, you have 4 delightful characters, which are meant to represent sporting mascots. They all have names. They all have a backstory. They all have 2 little eyes peeping out of a little slot. One is a great big gigantic hot dog. One's a bear. One's a huge fish. And one is Mum, who is the queen. And in Hot Streak, we are playing degenerate gamblers. Much like the degenerate board game addicts we are, where we like to gamble on how many years it's going to take for the latest crowdfunding to come in or whether it will deliver at all. Not so much these days, but in the early days. And so, you know, it's not such a long stretch to think that we're all degenerate gamblers. And what happens in Hot Streak is there are a number of cards that are flipped face up into a market, and the cards are associated with a specific racer. So they're color-coded for each racer, and then you've got these kind of army green cards. And an army green card will apply to all racers, and the cards will say things like move 2, or it'll say move -2, in which case you move backwards. It might say turn around, in which case you are facing the wrong way for the race. It might say fall down, in which case your racer is literally face down on the grid. And it doesn't matter how big of a card you flip. You could flip a move 3 and they drag their sorry ass 1 square. There are some that might say move 2, then swerve left. So they're running in all of a sudden in the wrong lane. So you've got a market of cards that are out and we can all see them. And then everyone who's playing on the side, we have a hand of 3 cards. And we look at the market that's down there and we take bets. So there are these betting cards that have diminishing returns. So if you want to bet on Gobbler, who's the great big bear to win, you take the Gobbler bet. And then the next bet available has fewer returns. So the first one pays 10 if you win, the second one pays 7, the third one pays 5. If you're feeling really confident that Gobbler's going to win, which you should not, by the way, because even if it looks like someone's going to win, that spoiler alert, they are not going to win. You can flip the tile over and it's a risky bet. So on the top side, you've got decent payouts for first, second, and third. And on the risky side, you've got a huge payout for first and then a really shitty one for second and third. And you go around the table and everyone takes a bet and it's a snake draft. And after that, everyone takes a bet coming back the other way. So everyone has two bets in front of them. Aside from betting on the four racers, there is a side bet that is open for each round. And the side bet might say something like, one of the racers will be crawling in the home stretch. And that means they've fallen down at some point in the last section of the race and they are crawling. And you can take a bet on either, yes, I think based on the market I can see or the cards in my hand, that yes, that one of the racers is going to be crawling, or no, they're not going to be crawling. And similarly, you can make those risky by flipping them over. Once everyone's placed their bets, everyone adds one card from their hand blind into the race deck. And it gets shuffled up, so the cards that you can see are in there, and then the cards you can't see. Last night we were playing 8, for example. 8 cards go into the deck. There are 6 in the deck, so it's 14 cards all up. 8 of them are cards that we've all put in. So the market deck ends up being pretty much toilet paper in the end, because you've got more of the deck that is just unseen. And then it gets wild. You shuffle it up, you burn the top 3 cards, 3, 2, 1, go, and you flip the cards. You've got one person flipping, one person moving and calling, and it is mayhem. It is mayhem and pointing and screaming and smacking the table as these four very special racers lurch and lumber and trip and fall, and then all of a sudden they're facing the wrong way, and then they draw a move 3, and they run off the track backwards. And if they move off the track in any way, shape, or form, they are disqualified. If they trip, and then they get another trip or a number stomach card they get run into, they're disqualified. Hot Streak is so much fun. We've played it here in the house with all my girls. The 5 of us have played. We played it at Super Troopers for his birthday celebrations twice yesterday. It is a bag of fun. I have no regrets about overpaying about 10, 12 bucks for it to get a copy from the US. If you can get your hands on Hot Streak, or somebody else has a copy of Hot Streak, or it's at a con, play Hot Streak. Like, honestly, I think it would be hilarious to play for real money. When I say real money, I mean like $5 or something. I think it would be freaking hilarious, because you think you can call what's happening. Maybe you can, but oh man. Hot Streak is by John Perry, art by Cecile Gariepi, and published by CMYK. Got a game. I haven't played this in a long time, but it's a favorite of the Foxes of mine. We played a game of Land versus Sea. This is one of the very adult, very risque things we did while we were away for the weekend. We played Land versus Sea outside at this beautiful table with the sun setting. Land versus Sea is a gorgeous little tile layer where basically you play 2 cartographers. One of you is building the map for the land. One of you is building the map for the sea. You put a tile out. If you close off an area, boom, you get points. The Fox rinsed me at this game. And I don't think she's ever beaten me. I think she was quite surprised herself. But she fucking rinsed me at Land versus Sea. And it was a delight. There's not much more to the game. It's a 20-minute game of tile laying. It is very much a take that and a screw you, because you can look at something and look at your opponent and go, oh, they're about to finish off that lovely little lake they're building. Well, let me put this huge lake tile out that opens it up and absolutely screws them so that I've got a little more time to make some points. It is a blast. The Fox managed to close two. There's 2 ways to play. You can go, I'm going to close off all these little teeny tiny ones. Great. Or you can go for the Uber one. And twice she closed off a space that was like 27 and 28 points each. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm just gonna quit now. Land versus Sea is by Jean-Paul Jacques, who's an Australian board game designer. He is an absolute gentleman of industry. I've had the pleasure of meeting him on 3 different occasions and playing his game with him. He's the designer and the artist, and it is published by Good Games here in Australia. Land versus Sea is a fun time. There's 3 or 4 modules in the base box, different ways you can play with sea serpents and coral and mountains. I think we've played that version once, but I think we've all decided we just love the basic Land versus Sea. It's very tidy. Oh, well, I love cheese. You love cheese? Everyone loves cheese? Well, we got in a game. Super Trooper has received the latest cheesy goodness, Formaggio, which is the Italian cheese game. It's the sequel / follow-up to Fromage, which, of course, is French. And the next one will be Queso. They're releasing Queso, the Spanish version. They're not releasing Queso. For what it's worth, I hope they do, because then Super Trooper can get the big triple stacker. He can make like the Tower of Cheese games, and we can have Queso and Fromage and Formaggio. For what it's worth, I hope they release Queso next. I think that would be fantastic. You have little burros carrying your cheese around for area control. Formaggio, it's fromage, but it's got a lightly different Italian skin on it. When you're in Venice, you're putting out little gondolas, and the more gondolas you put out around your specific cheese, the more points you get. In fromage, you've got three workers. They're shaped like wheels of cheese. You've got one that makes yellow cheese, one that makes white cheese, and one that makes blue cheese. And on your turn, you've got a quadrant of this huge, beautiful Lazy Susan facing you, and you're faced with a mini game. There's a mini game in front of you. And up at the top of that mini game, there's a way to get specific resources. So you can possibly put two workers out. And the more powerful placement there is in the mini game, the further around the clock, anti-clockwise, the point of your cheese wedge is pointing. So if I'm getting a little benefit, the cheese wedge is going to point right. If I'm getting a moderate benefit, it's going to point up. And if I'm getting a really good benefit, it's going to point left. And if it is like world-ending quality cheese, it's pointing straight at me. And this is important because after your turn, the whole great big Lazy Susan wheel rotates 90 degrees and your little wedge is pointing 90 degrees to the right. So each turn, the little wedge that you've put out is going to turn 90 degrees, and when it's pointing back at you is when you get to take it back. So if you are like, well, I want this really big, beautiful benefit, you're committing that worker for three or four turns possibly. Or you can take little tiny benefits and you get your workers back very quickly. It's delight. Formaggio, like fromage, it's four mini games, and you've got another little mini game on your player board that involves converting berries into fruits to have a cheese or preserve to have a cheese. You have cows, you're collecting cows, and cows will make free cheese, because that's what cows do, right? They don't charge you for the services, they just eat your grass and they pump out free cheese. That's how a cow works, isn't it? Grass in, cheese out, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, Formaggio's great. I love Formaggio, I love fromage, I will play it anytime. Allegedly, you can mix and match the four minigames from Formaggio with the four minigames from Fromage. So, more cheese. More cheese is always good stuff. This is by Ben Rosset, Pavel Joba, and published by Road to Infamy Games. And it's just recently delivered here in Australia pursuant to successful crowdfunding. Congratulations, guys. I look very much forward to Queso and Burros next year. On one of the tables, Super Trooper had two tables set up for his birthday party yesterday. They had Teotihuacan. I wasn't quite in the mood for a 4.5 hour game about fucking cocoa. I want to say fucking cocoa. I love cocoa, but the whole game's like, oh, I need more fucking cocoa. So I played a few mini games on the side, little games. Well, they went and battled it out for cocoa supremacy. And I played a game of Monolith with a Y by Phil Walker Harding. Now, Monolith, I've talked about in this on this therapy session with you before. Monolith has a number of 3D Tetris pieces, and you've got a little plate in front of you that is 4x4 in a grid, and you are collecting these little Tetris pieces and trying to build up a cube. In a four-player game, you're building a three-level cube. In a two-player game, you're building a four-level cube. And there's other things going on, right? You've also got to nominate how many points each side of your monolith is going to earn. And this is where I absolutely fornicated myself in this particular game. Because on your little plate that you're building, you have four different colored walls. There are five colors of tiles in the game. And so there's like yellow and blue and red and black and creamy white, I think. Anyway, I had a plan. Because what you also have to do is on your turn, there are a number of tokens on the board. And on your turn, you can take one of those tokens. And those tokens have numbers 4 through 12 on them. And you got to grab one and you click it into it like a little puzzle piece on the side of your plate. And if you put the 12 on one side, you're saying, I'm going to get 12 squares facing that side of the monolith. So the monolith, for example, one of the sides is white. You've got to build white facing out on that side. With me, and of course it's 4 cubes long. So of course the monolith is 5 cubes wide. It's 4 cubes wide, 3 cubes tall, so the most you can face on a side is 12. So I grab the 12, no problem, click it in. I've played this game before, should be able to get 12, no problem. And then I promptly ended up building my white wall on the wrong side of my monolith. So there's that. And hilarity ensued. Lots of laughs and finger pointing. And I'm okay with that. I'm totally over it. It's fine. I think Monolith is really, really fun. You can teach it in about 5 minutes. And it's a thinky puzzle that you sit on. for about 25 to 30 minutes. It's built in 3D, and it's as simple as you've got a marker, you're moving around the board, you can move 1 to 4 spaces, and you are either going to take the tile that's there, the 3D little piece, or you're going to take one of the scoring opportunities, and you're going to click that in your monolith. Here's the fun bit. If you choose the 12 and you click it in, you get 12 points if you get 12 facing out. If you get 11 facing out, you get exactly 0 points. So you've got to be confident that you're going to be able to do it. It really helps if you build the right color wall facing the right color tile. I mean, that's really the secret to this game, is if you say you're going to build a wall with 12 white tiles, that you don't actually build the white tiles on a separate wall. Just a tip. I've played it 3 or 4 times, and the tip for me to you is if you say you're going to build 12 white tiles on the right wall, don't build 12 white tiles on the left wall. Yeah, well, there's that. I like Monolith. I think Monolith was well received at the table. It's easy. The Peanut plays Monolith. You can play it down to age 8, 9, and 10. You can play it up to age 35,000. And every one of you will be Brain Bernie. And I'm 51. And as I said, I managed to build my wall on entirely the wrong side. So I'm not actually of diminished IQ. It was a mistake. I am human. That was by Phil Walker Harding. Art by David Tosello. And actually published by Simon. I guess because there's plastic. Simon likes plastic. So played after that, and I actually played several games of this in the last couple of weeks. In fact, I played several games of this before the last pod and completely forgot to mention the game. We've been playing a fair bit of Origin Story. So we've been playing Origin Story, which is a recent Stonemaier release. It's a trick-taking game involving superheroes. And Origin Story, as far as trick-takers go, it's pretty wild. It's very simple. You've got 4 suits of cards. They go 1 to 13. You could probably play it just as easily with regular cards. I mean, the suits wouldn't match. But in theory, all you're doing is it's a must-follow. It's a must-follow. You've got cards. You get dealt 8 cards. So in a 4-player game, there's 32 cards out of the 52. So you have a number of cards that are hidden information that you don't know whether or not they're in and out. Well, it's all hidden information if it's not in your hand. But you actually don't know. Like, if you've got the 12 of strength, which is a little red fist, you don't even know if the 13's in the game, unfortunately, unless you're holding it yourself. And so you get these cards, 8 cards, easy, right? And then you've got a little comic book player board that opens up, and on there is a beautiful painting of it's a watercolor of a superhero with a name and a little tiny backstory-ish, and then you've got a starting superpower. The superpower might be, on your turn, if you win a trick, you can discard a card and draw a card from the deck, right? So it gives you a chance to cycle some of your cards and maybe get a bit of power. And you start the game with 1 charge that you can put out. And then you play. And so every round starts, you're going to get 3 superhero story cards. You're going to pick one of those to add to your comic book. And on round 1, you're going to have 1 charge, and you're going to have a choice of 2 different powers to charge. So you have to select those. And then you've got your scoring wheels. You've got your little counter, looks like a little superhero mask, and one side is a superhero, one side is a supervillain, and you in secret select whether you're going to play the hero or the villain. If you're the hero, you want to win tricks. If you're the villain, you're basically bidding void. You want to win no tricks. And if you win on a void bid, you get 4 points. Now, there are only 8 points in a round. There are 8 cards played in a round, so 4 points based on the tricks is bonanza in Origin Story. And so you play your 8 tricks, and if you've won tricks, you get points, and if you have come up void, you get 4 points, and if you're somewhere in between, you might get some points, or you might get no tricks and you didn't bid void, in which case you swear a little, you put your cards down, and you move on. Second round, we deal out 8 cards, you get 3 more superpowers to choose from, and you get another charge. So in round 2, you get 2 charges for your powers, and you have 3 powers to choose from. And the powers start to get, you start off by going, oh, well, my powers this round are this and this. And by round 4, everyone's got 4 powers. There's 16 superpowers at the table. It's like, come on, guys, just tell me when you screw me what your power is, because I can't keep it straight. The other layer on this is in round 3, you flip an event card. There's something like 24 events included with the game. And you flip 1, and that event card has an overlay of some sort of difference for that particular round 3. And in round 5, instead of getting new superhero cards, you've received 2 starter cards at the start of the game, which have superhero personas, final personas on the back, and there's some round 5 you know, explosion, reveal, whatever. And this is meant to be you ascending into your final form as a superhero. And you choose one, you flip it, and you follow the instructions on it. It usually has something wild and wacky for round five, and you play round five. I've never won Origin Story. I've never not had a great time playing Origin Story. I think it's a clever bit of game. I think it only takes about half an hour, maybe 35 minutes. I think it's remarkably easy to teach because it's a simple must-follow with the Trump suit. If somebody plays a three of power, you've got to play power. If you don't, you can play off suit. And if you want to win the trick, you can play a trump. And you will win so long as no one else plays a higher trump. I think it's great. I think it's the rules overhead is very simple. I think the edge cases of how the powers interplay is where it layers on some complexity. But I really enjoy Origin Story. The art is absolutely stunning. It's by Clementine Campardieu, who also did Wormspan. This is designed by Jamie Stegmaier and Pete Wessinger. And of course, published by Stonebuyer Games. On a side note, if you do a quick search online, you can find the original art, and it is gorgeous. When I say original art, I don't mean prints. The actual OG watercolor paintings that were done for this game are for sale by Clementine. I have disposable income. I don't have disposable income to buy a painting of a superhero, or indeed you can get OG Wormspan paintings. They are stunningly beautiful. If you like that kind of stuff, you need to go have a look. And and they're there. Follow that with another trick taker that I'm quite fond of right now. It's a very different origin story. This is called Three Chapters. Now, Three Chapters is a fairy tale based trick taking game. And you've got basically 50 cards. There are 50 cards. And again, art on these cards is so, so nice. And in Three Chapters, the three chapters ostensibly are draft your cards, play the tricks, score your cards. So what's interesting about these cards, or what's clever about them, is they're all fairy tale related. And so one card might be Jack, and at the bottom of the Jack card it says, if with the beanstalk you get 5 gems. So Jack can be with the beanstalk in two different ways. It can be played into the same trick. Are you kidding me? So you might have, for example, Jack on the card, and at the bottom it'll say, if with the beanstalk, get 5 gems. Now, Jack can be with the beanstalk in one of two different ways. If somebody else plays the beanstalk into the trick and you play Jack, you're going to get 5 gems, whatever's at the bottom, right? And then, at the end of the game, if you happen to have Jack and the beanstalk both in your hand of 8 cards or seven cards that you start with, then you are going to get those 5 gems. So game starts, you're dealt 8 cards, and you do a Sushi Go style draft where you keep one, you pass to the left. Once you've got 7 cards in your hand, the 8th one goes in the box. And there are 50 cards. And if you play 4 players, you're only going to see 32 of the 50. So there are plenty that aren't in. And that's where I guess the wrinkle of, not frustration, but where you really just, you don't have perfect information to try and track what's in the deck, what's playing off each other. And so once you've got your 7 cards, you play your 7 tricks. And look, it's breezy, it's fun, the art is gorgeous, and I think that it's quite a little delight. And you play your 7 tricks, at the end you're going to score all kinds of intermingling scoring. You've got Tweedledee and Tweedledum, for example. If Tweedledee is with Tweedledum, you might get 2 hearts. There are 3 different tokens, stars, hearts, and gems. They all score different things, as in different values. And Three Chapters is 25 minutes of charm. The art is gorgeous. It's very easy to table. It's in a tiny box, easy to carry everywhere. Three Chapters by John Hoot, art by Jan Bintakis, and published by Amigo Games. Well, once we got through with our trick-taking marathon, it wasn't a marathon, I suppose, it was just 2 games, we played Ink. Ink of recent release by Casper Lapp. So Ink is up there with the most unnecessarily produced games I think that I have played in a very long time. And I say that with affection, not with discrimination. In Ink, each player has a bag of little ink bottles, little crystalline ink bottles, and the purple ones, because of course Hammers only plays purple, are gorgeous and lustrous and sparkly, and they're basically little ink bottles, and you've got 25 of them. One of them sits on a rondelle that goes round and round the mulberry bush. You've got 12 on a specific palette card, and that card will have 2 different colors on it. You've got 12 that are sitting on the table. and you get a little tile to start. And these tiles have little swirly segments in them. I think ostensibly you're creating a painting with these tiles as you link them together. And I won't go down, it's going to be very hard for me to describe this one without some sort of visual cue, but basically you're drafting tiles each turn, and you go round the rondelle in the middle of the table, and there are a number of tiles around this rondelle. So you move around the rondelle, you grab a tile, you add it to yours, and you're starting a tableau of tiles, and you're trying to build clusters of color. And these clusters of color have little white spots on them. And then when you eventually score your clusters, you're going to drop ink bottles onto those spots. And it's a shading game. There is no score. There is no points in this game. It's literally you want to get rid of all your ink bottles first. So big clusters are great, but big clusters take longer to fill. Small clusters are easier to fill. And the extra little wrinkle is on your little palette card. So if you have a palette card like mine had purple and red swirls on it, those bottles can only go into purple and red clusters. So if you don't get those out early, you could get a little bit stuck trying to fill those out. Whereas the 12 that are not on the card can go into any color. There's a few more rules beyond that, but it's a very easy teach. It is very pretty on the table. It's about 30, 35, maybe 40 minutes. I think the Fox would like this one because it's just so gorgeous and tactile. And that's Ink by Casper Lapp, art by Chris Quilliams, and published by Final Score Games. I don't think it's even that expensive. I think both Project L and Super Trooper own this one. I think Super Trooper said he picked it up at Amazon for like $40 or something. And honestly, you get a game for $40, you play it twice, and you're happy with that. I mean, you want to play it a lot more than that, but you're return on investment is not particularly onerous. After that, we played, what did I end up calling this? Fuck you, fuck me, fuck everyone, the game. This is Tacta. Tacta is a small box of cards that have little colors on them that look like the Tron light cycles have ridden all over them, and they've got dots for points. I'm going to do my best to describe this game without rage flipping the table. Now, when I say rage flipping the table, I really enjoyed this game. I really enjoyed Tacta. Tacta is basically get effed the game. You spend the whole game trying to play your card on the table while simultaneously screwing as many people as you possibly can. And so basically what happens is there's a starting card on the table, and these all have little cutout, cutout outlines on them, not cutouts, but they're little outlines on them that you can lay the silhouette of another part of another card over top. And certain parts of cards have dots on them in your player colors. So of course I had the purple deck, and you're going to lay these cards out in such a way that follows the rules. They can overlap in some ways and not in others. And then when all the cards are out, what's going to happen is the most dots you have of your color facing up will be your points. Well, yay, you win. So enter the middle finger. In Tacta, there are plenty of ways to lay your cards smack dab on top of someone else's, gazumping their points and replacing them with your own. The rule set on Tacta, I think it's about three sentences. Put your card down. This is how it goes down. Can't go down this way. Off you fuck. And a half hour later, and many, many bad words, and many, many insults around the table, you have a score of some sort. I enjoyed playing Tacta. I would never buy it. I think in this house, it would end up with somebody getting throat punched. I don't mean the Fox now. I mean like the teenagers. I have one teenager who doesn't play many games, but if I did get her to this game, I think it would end in a shanking. And I thoroughly enjoyed Tacta as much as I thoroughly loathed Tacta. It's much like another game we played. And Tacta is by Jason Tremblay, published by the OP Games. No artist credit. The OP Games, I think, are also responsible for the recent Flip 7, I believe. So Tacta, small box, bunch of cards, whole bunch of bad feelings, and love and hate. Yay. Oh, man, after that, oh. Coop and Super Trooper and Sarah Lee and Battleships and I, it was five of us, we played Cthulhu Death May Die. Now, if you want to hop onto our Facebook page, you can see the mini, a mini in air quotes, Dr. Evil style, which we were fondly referring to as Coop's toddler. This is the Cthulhu mini from one of the recent Kickstarters that is actually almost a meter tall. And it sits in the middle of the table, and you have a few tiles that sit around it, and you have to move around, and you have to cast these incantations to weaken different body parts and then hack them off and work your way down Cthulhu. And if you haven't played Cthulhu, Death May Die, it should be called Cthulhu, You're Dead. Or Cthulhu, You Almost Won. Or Cthulhu, Mahaha. I have played a lot of Cthulhu with Death May Die. I own 2 boxes worth of Cthulhu Death May Die Season 1, Season 2. I almost exclusively play it solo because you can. It's not hard to play solo at all. I normally play 2 or 3-handed solo. I have played Cthulhu Death May Die multiplayer a few times. This was a glorious scenario. It's called the Epic Rylaeth scenario, something like that. It's hilarity. It's awesome. You have no hope. Like, you honestly have no hope. I mean, 3 turns in, all of our locations were swarmed. There was shit everywhere. Most of us were half dead. And yet somehow a half hour later, we managed to squeak out a victory just at the last possible moment before the last couple of characters both died and or went insane. Cthulhu Death May Die is all dice all the time, but it is... Yeah. I really like Cthulhu Death May Die. When it came to the table, because there were 9 or 10 of us there, and you know, the game comes out, I'm like, oh, who wants to play? And I'm often happy to say, look, I'm happy to sit out. I've just played a game. I literally said, I will arm wrestle someone to get at this table because I love Cthulhu Death May Die. When this 94-centimeter Cthulhu model that's lovingly painted by Coop, beautiful job, came out, I just went, yeah, no. I was ready to elbow my grandmother out of the way to get to the table. We won. Don't even care. It was the experience of Cthulhu Death May Die. It was fantastic. It's by Eric Lang, Rob DeVau, art by everyone, and published by Simon. When I say art by everyone, there's like 14 artists. And unfortunately, I couldn't remember which of the 99 Cthulhu Death May Die Kickstarter campaigns this came from, so I can't even help you. But it was fabulous. Loved every second. And we won. Then later that evening, this was a long day. We played like 12 games in this day. It was fantastic. I played Art Society. Now, Art Society is this breezy, gentle little tile layer that has all kinds of conflagrations. So you get halfway through. So you've got paintings, you've got a wall, you're hanging paintings on the wall. That's the game. There's a blind bid. You're blind bidding at auction for the paintings. And I gazumped Dustin 4 bids in a row. He was playing his single biggest card, I think, and I gazumped him on the tiebreak 4 bids in a row, which was really quite funny. Not that I won. I don't think I won the game. But you're bidding in rounds of auction, and out come these paintings, and you hang paintings on a wall. And there are rules for how you hang the paintings on the wall. And if you have certain spaces that aren't filled, you lose points, and paintings have... There's a market that escalates and de-escalates on the side. Or no, it doesn't de-escalate. It only goes up. There's a market evaluation for paintings based on scarcity. And so the more scarce paintings are worth more points. The most common paintings are worth the fewest points. And look, heaps of fun. The fox would really love this one. I think she loves the tile layer. The rule set on this is very, very light. The crunch comes into the fact, well, I've got a painting with a wooden frame. I want to hang it next to a painting with a wooden frame. But you can't hang 2 landscapes together because that's a faux pas. And if you hang 2 landscapes together, they don't score at all. And... Great fun. You can rush the ending if you like, which I kind of saw the game was running away from me. And I thought, well, you know what? I can just... Because on your turn, you're choosing what size paintings to pull out of the box for auction. So you can pull teeny tiny paintings, which are easy for everyone to put out. Or you can pull big fat paintings, which are very hard for everyone to put out. Art Society was great. I really enjoyed it. I think Buttercup's got the new Uber Deluxe version backed on Kickstarter, which has lovely little metal pieces. And I think... You know, real oil paintings. No, it doesn't really have real oil paintings, but it's lovely. This game is by Mitch Wallace. Art is by 10 bazillion people. And in fact, if you look at the paintings are all based on actual classical art paintings. It's very pretty. It's very Buttercup. And this is going to be published by Mighty Boards. Well, it has been published by Mighty Boards and 10 other publishers. So Art Society has done the rounds. She gets around. Oh, the day was coming to a close, but we did manage to squeeze in a game of Planet Unknown. Now, I've talked about Planet Unknown in the past. Planet Unknown is the Lazy Susan tile laying game where you've got a planet with asteroids and all kinds of stuff. It tracks the game, tracks, and tiles, and you get what you get. And if you you know, there's no point in complaining. Somebody's going to spin the Lazy Susan and stop it how it suits them, and then you just have to suck whatever's in front of you, right? It is the glory hole of games, right? You don't get a choice. You're just perched there. Whatever pops out of that Lazy Susan, that's yours. Enjoy. I'm not sure after, I think, 3 or 4 games is where I sit on PlanetOne. It's fine. I enjoy it enough. I don't think I'd ever request it, and I don't know why. I don't dislike it, but I don't like it. I think I am Planet Unknown ambivalent, agnostic. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, the fact that Voldemort has the really, really pretty version was great. There's all the little plasticky bits, and it's very pretty. Planet Unknown's fine. It's fine. It's fine. I don't want to go much more into that. I've talked about Planet Unknown a couple of times. It's by Ryan Lambert and Adam Rayberg. Art by Yoma and published by Adams Apple Games. Oh, God. Oh, we finished the day. I say, oh, God. With a game that I've come to call double fisting the game, because it comes at you from both sides with no spit, I think is how I described it last time. This is Far Away. Let me be clear. I love Far Away. I also loathe Far Away, right? And this is why I call it, and even the gameplay is like a double fister, right? So Far Away, you're drafting cards and you're playing them down in front of you left to right. And at the end of the game, they're going to score right to left. So you think you've made a plan. You think you've got it all sorted. So you're going to play your first card and the card will say you need 5 pineapples. I don't know what they are. We call them pineapples. They look like little pineapples. And those 5 pineapples have to be to the right of that card somewhere, or that card scored 0. Now, you may or may not get 5 pineapples over the rest of the game, because this card has an initiative on it. And if that initiative is 47, you're probably picking last from the market in that round. And you're going to get one that maybe you're lucky and it has pineapples. Maybe it has little masks. Maybe it has the little green tablets. I don't even know what these things are. The art of Far Away is gorgeous. It's got this like Aztec Incan sort of anime, cartoony. It's really pretty. And the iconography is great. But you're going to draft 8 cards, and then you're going to score them backwards and discover that 7 of the 8 cards get you 0 points. In the case of the cracker, 8 of 8 cards got him 0 points. It was so funny, and he's such a good fucking sport. I just love that man. Honestly, like, it was just... We should actually start on game nights like a pool for where the cracker's going to land on each game, because I just think he is one of the greatest sportsmen that I've ever sat at the table with, and it was all hilarity. Far Away is great, and Far Away is horrifying. I don't know if it's a very expensive game. I can't imagine. It's a tiny little box with tiny little cards. It's a half hour of swearing. I will actually play Far Away anytime. I will never bring it into this house because I think the fox would divorce me. But Far Away is awesome. Johannes Goopy, art by Corentin Lebras. Oh, sorry. No. Far Away is by Johannes Goopy and... Corentin Lebras, art by Maxime Morin, published by Catch Up Games. And at 37 minutes and 53 seconds, those are the games that were. Boxes on the doorstep, new delights inside. Heaven's on fire, feels to divide. This week on Incoming, it's a little Britney Spears. It's a little, oops, I did it again. No, this is not, okay. Did I buy more games? We'll get to that. But no, also, yes, but no. So Hot Streak came in, obviously. I caved and ordered it from overseas. I've already had that confessional. Thank you very much for hearing my confession and absolving me of all sins. As of yesterday, Speakeasy by the love of my life, Vital Acerta, arrived. It is the biggest Vital box I have ever seen. It is at least 80% thicker than Lisboa. It's here. It's waiting for me to unbox and punch out. I will probably play a two-handed game later in the week before tackling the solo, before making all my friends sit at the table and play gangsters with me. Clank Catacombs, the most recent Kickstarter with deluxe goodies, arrived. I wasn't expecting it. It actually arrived yesterday as well. This was not meant to deliver till February. I know that Underworld has been delivering, but I ordered the metallic cubes and the metallic coins, and they were very clear that was going to delay shipment till next year for everybody because that hadn't been done yet. But surprise, motherfucker, it's all here. So Clank Catacombs, 2 expansions arrived with the deluxe goodies. If you have not seen the Clank Catacombs deluxe metal cubes, go look. If you own Clank and don't own the cubes, don't look, because these are not just little metal cubes. These things are the sexiest little add-on. And then I received last week a copy of Regicide Legacy. This is courtesy of Luke Badger and Badgers from Mars. This is a review copy that we've received. I will be speaking to Luke on the show in the coming few weeks. And he was very keen for me to get a go at Regicide Legacy, to get that under my belt so we can have a good chat about it. So that is here. I am looking forward to dragging some friends to the table. Not much of a drag. They're probably waiting outside now taking numbers so we can play through Regicide Legacy so I can have a great chat with Luke. Luke is a legend of a human being. I had the pleasure of meeting Luke a couple of years ago face to face and had a wonderful time and very much looking forward to getting Regicide Legacy to the table. Those are the games that have been incoming in the past 2 weeks. There's still like 5 weeks in the year though, so there's plenty of time for more games to arrive. I have more that are on back order. I have more that have been pre-ordered. I have a couple more Kickstarters that, I mean, if I'm lucky, they might not be here before the Fat Man, but pretty darn close. That's incoming. Welcome to FOMO Mofo, where I take you through my personal angst-ridden journey of capitalist acquisitionism. As always, this is not an exhaustive list of crowdfunding projects, but merely those that are my personal attention, either because they are by a design and development team I like, a theme that I enjoy, or because they have pretty toys. And let me tell you how happy a Hammers is when it's all three. Just when you think you're done, they pull you back in! Came across a little racist. I'm sorry to anyone who knows someone who has an accent even vaguely similar to that. I don't even know what I was going for there. It was meant to be a little Scarface, and I no idea what that was. This week, there are only a couple that I'm watching. Thank God. The first is the reprint of Iridia, The Paths We Dare Tread. Now, Iridia is a game coming out by... Is it Far Off? Far Off Games. Far Off Games is a small indie publisher. Iridia is a campaign, co-op, story-driven, pre-deluxified. Everything in Iridia comes deluxe. The minis are painted. You can swap the minis out as in for your basic character. You can change the heads. You can change the weapons. So whatever you're playing, you go click, 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 and you actually have the mini that you're playing, which I think is amazing and unnecessary, and I love every minute of it. It's got advent calendar-like reveals, so you've got all these boxes with windows in them, and if you cross certain threshold, they go, open window 416B9412, and you go, crack, and you go, oh, there's a little monster in there, and you fight the monster. Or it could be a new weapon that you swap into your mini, or, it is gorgeous, it is deluxe, it is something that I didn't back the first time it was around, because at that particular time, all of my funds were committed to other games, and I think I just picked up Agamonia. And I still have Oathsworn sitting there. I'm like, oh, do I need another campaign? And then it came out and I watched the gameplay videos. I'm like, yeah, I need another campaign. Cody Miller, who is head of Far Off Games, is a legend of a human being. Okay, if you haven't heard my story about Cody Miller and my challenges with Zaya, Legends of Drist System, it's back a few episodes back. I won't rehash that. But Cody Miller is a beautiful human being who is very passionate about what he does with this. In this campaign, if you do have Zaya and you are missing anything, you can pick up everything for Zaya, even the stuff that's out of print. All in for Iridia is just a hair over $400 with shipping at a further 60, which is a very respectable 15%. And to be honest, for the amount of game that comes with this, at $400 Australian is a bit of a bargain. Very, very delighted. If you want to see something that will warm the cockles of your heart, go over to Far Off Games Facebook page and find the video of Cody and his family watching the campaign tick over to funded. It is a very sweet little moment in time and a reminder that, yeah, it's $400, but this is $400 that's funding someone's dream. And I am delighted to say I am all in for Iridia. I will probably end up playing it solo like I'm playing Agamonia, but who knows? You know, we'll see. It might be something I end up playing with the Peanut or the Fox or just solo. It's gorgeous. It looks great. And I love everything about Far Off Games and what they stand for and what they're doing. And the customer service at Far Off Games is second to none. So that's Iridia, The Paths We Dare Tread, getting a reprint. The second is a game that I knew was coming. I saw it coming. I'm like, oh, it's not my thing. I probably won't be getting it. And that is Vitalis Serta's new game, The Great Library. Now, The Great Library is based on the Library of Alexandria, of course, art by Ian O'Toole. The cover of The Great Library has the classic Nine Muses on it. of course, the Nine Muses being the classic Nine Muses of great culture in ancient times. One of my daughters is named after one of the great Nine Muses, and so it's very near and dear to my heart. The Great Library is not necessarily, but look, I've had a look, I've watched some gameplay videos. This kind of looks like it's Scholars of the South Tigris, but with more grunt, and I mean that in a good way. This is the first game that I know of that I can recall of Vitellus Artis that involves dice. Now, there are dice in this game that are counters that you're flipping around for certain strengths, but there are dice that you're actually rolling in this that are, and you're using that result as part of, I don't know what yet. I haven't watched a full video. It's a Lacerda, so you know what you're getting, right? The theme's not necessarily 100% my thing, but if I'm being honest, I didn't think Lisboa was either. I looked at Lisboa, I'm like, wow, that art's really left of center. Like, it's really specific. It's really niche. The gameplay on Lisboa is so great. And when you go down the history of what happened in Lisboa at that particular time, which, you know, Vital being a fine Portuguese gentleman, was very, very keen and happy to share with in the rule book. The rule book in Lisboa has all these lovely little vignettes and stories about what happened at the time, historically what was going on. And you can see that in the mechanics for the different aspects of the game. It really shines and comes through in Lisboa. Lisboa, I think, is a triumph of gaming. And it's not the kind of game where I looked at and went, oh, that's really grabbing me. I think I want to go play a game about the rebuilding of Lisboa in the 1700s. Yeah, 100%. That's what I want to be doing with my life. Lisboa is stellar. The thing I want to say about the Great Library, and I've been waiting all year for this because price creep in the last 12 months has been a very real thing. We've seen it where games that we think, well, we would normally pay about $120, $150, $160. They're now going for $220, $250, $300. Games are getting really expensive. Now, from the best of my knowledge, and best of my memory, I should say, I have backed the last three campaigns. I have backed the campaigns for Weather Machine, for Inventions, and for Speakeasy. So I've backed the last three campaigns by Eagle Griffin Games. And to the best that I can recall, I think every single one of those was sitting around the $170 to $180 mark for the games. Australian. I was talking Australian because that's where all my money comes from. And I was really keen to see what they were going to do this year and how they were going to approach this year and what sort of pricing we were looking at because of tariffs and because of shipping and because of all the uncertainty and whatnot. And the Great Library is on Kickstarter for $184 Australian. I thought that to me is quite remarkable given that Eagle Griffin Games, and in particular Eagle Griffin's publications of Vitellus Artis games, are the platinum standard for component quality. Now, there's not necessarily any metal or chunky plastic. It's all wood and cardboard. But the punch boards for Eagle Griffin Games, for, you know, they've got different grades that they do, of course. But when they're doing a Lacerda game, the punch boards, they feel like wood. The punch boards feel like pieces of wood. They are so dense. They are so thick. They are so well cut. The cardstock is fantastic. The boards are amazing. And so the fact that we're getting this year's Eagle Griffin Lacerda for $184 Australian, which with $36 shipping, which is a hair under 20%, which is the space at which I'm like, I'm perfectly happy with that. I have paid more for a game that I think won't go to retail, and I really think it's worth having in the bunker. But I think that that price point, it's one of those things that I'm a Lacerda fan. I love Lacerda's games. They may not get to the table as much as I'd like. But if at a later date, I think, wow, I'd really like to have the Great Library, it's going to cost me $300. That's what the retail pricing is for these games. Which also means if I get it and I'm like, it's really not for me, I'm going to be able to sell it for at least what I paid for it. Not that that's likely to happen. So yeah, Lacerda, Library of Alexandria, it's probably going to go into my crowdfunding queue. And that is what it is. That's the only two that I'm really following. And thank fuck for that, because oh my God. In crowdfunding news, I don't often do crowdfunding news, but it's worth mentioning, The Witcher Legacy launches this week and now has the crown for most followed pre-campaign on GameFound, with over 69,000 people following this prior to launch. I'm not saying it's going to be a good game. I have no idea. But that's something. 69,000 people. That's a small city all following The Witcher Legacy. Also for noting, guys, there are dozens and dozens of campaigns running right now for smaller indie projects. And I mean dozens. Like, I had a quick look. I stopped counting at like 35. Stuff that's funding for, you know, and it's meet its funding goal, but funding for $20,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 or even at $300,000, that's still a small project. I know we're all tapped out, but if you have some cash to throw around to fill somebody's dream, you know, like Cody Miller at Far Off Games, you know, that's a $400 buy. It doesn't have to be. I think if you just want the base game, it's a lot less, not a lot less, some less. But lots of people out there that they are putting themselves out there and they have a dream of bringing something to your table that brings joy. Have a look, right? It's not charity. That's not what this is. But it's just saying, hey, I can help someone with their dream. For me, I'm definitely done for the year. Definitely 100% done for the year. No more crowdfunding, no more purchasing games. Seriously, please stop. Also, in the news, Fantasy Flight Games just announced today that coming to crowdfunding will be a pirate-themed Zombicide. Well played, Fantasy Flight. Well played. And fuck my life. There's no voices in my head this week. This week instead, I am going to bring to you an interview that I had this week with the inimitable Jamie Stegmaier. I reached out to Jamie some weeks ago, because I know my schedule is rough and his schedule is probably way rougher than mine, and just reached out after Origin Story published, because as you know, here on OMC, I regularly try and talk to people in my series Not All Heroes Wear Capes about their own origin story. But I've had the pleasure of talking to the likes of Paul Grogan and Mark Bigney and Michael Walker over at So Very Wrong About Games. I have a few other guests lined up for the coming 3 months. And Jamie Stegmaier was always on my list of people to reach out to. And I suppose I was always hesitant because, you know, once you reach out and they say no, that door is shut. Well, let me tell you, I reached out. He said, yeah, heck yeah. Absolutely. Here, what are you looking at? And I gave him a date and a window and he went, yep, let's do it. We locked it in and I had the most delightful chat. So settle in. It's about 30 minutes. I have an origin story coming to you of Jamie Stegmaier. Welcome back, OMC crew, to our regular show. And we are pleased to welcome a very special guest today. The one, the only, the ineffable Jamie Stegmaier. Jamie, welcome to One Man Clapping.
I am honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a delight to have you. My regular listeners know that we, from time to time, get the chance to talk to some of the, greater contributors in this wonderful industry, and we are delighted to have you. So what we'd like to do is just have a small peek behind the curtain into your own origin story. I will not lie. When I started this channel about a year and a half ago, I made a list of people that I would love to talk to because I am a mad board gamer. And I would be absolutely lying if I said your name wasn't at the top of the list. With the recent release of Origin Story, I thought, oh, this is a spectacularly serendipitous time to try and reach out and see if I can grab a bit of your time. So thank you in advance. And with that, I'd just like to get started.
Absolutely.
Could you share with us, if you can, go back as far as you can, what's your first board gaming memory? Your first, I guess, significant board gaming memory?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have like a list of early games that I always rattle off, but the idea of my first memory is a great way to ask it. And honestly, I think it may go all the way back to playing with an already tattered deck of Millborn. Have you ever played Millborn? It's a really old game.
I have not. Millborn. I'm going to make a note and look it up, though. Tell me about Millborn. Yeah.
It's a French card game that I haven't played in years, so I don't even remember all the specifics of it, but I believe it is a racing game using cards that you're playing, and there's a lot of kind of take that mechanisms. I have good memories of playing that game very early on with my family. I have a brother, sister, mom, and dad, and I just being in our living room as kids, probably 8, 9, maybe 10 years old, playing this,
nice,
this tattered copy of this card game. Many other games played at the time, but that came to mind as a very specific memory.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So your gaming life started with your siblings at home, I'm assuming, once the snows landed in St. Louis. Did you grow up in St. Louis?
I grew up in Virginia.
Okay.
And I spent the first 18 years of my life there. And then I came to university here in St. Louis, where I still am today.
Yeah. So tell me about, I guess, your growth and evolution as a gamer. How did that evolve? It started with Millborn, and obviously there's a number of games. I'm assuming, I don't know how old you are, but this is probably late 80s. I'm guessing something similar to that. How did it grow? Right. How did your gaming life start after Millborn?
Well, I was fortunate that I had siblings and parents and friends who were interested in a variety of games growing up. So I did play a bunch. I played, I'm blanking on a few of the names, but I know I played chess, I played Risk, I played Scotland Yard, a game that I still enjoy and play. I played Magic the Gathering. And those were kind of my childhood games.
Yeah.
And then I went off to college here in St. Louis. And here, I would say the main game that I played in college was Hearts. We played Hearts almost every day in college,
Wow.
at least in my sophomore year specifically. I remember doing that.
Because Hearts is a classic. I grew up in a bridge household. I was raised by my grandmother. I grew up in a bridge household. I was playing bridge and cribbage, I think, before I could walk. And I grew up about 1,000 miles north of you in a very, very chilly place. So there's about 5 months of the year where you've got nothing to do but play games.
Right.
So, sorry, continue. So
Well,
you
I
came
was
to St.
actually gonna
Louis.
ask you, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I think of Scotland Yard as being one of the Scotland Yard, and I play a little bit of Magic every now and then, but Scotland Yard is one that I have played for probably 30 years. Are there
Wow.
any games from your childhood other than, I guess, Bridge and Cribbage that maybe you still play that you still think hold up to this day?
It's interesting, because I grew up in Winnipeg in the late 70s and early 80s, and there were three TV channels, all in black and white. And so we basically, my sister and I had one sibling, and we were raised by our grandmother. And so we played all the old, we played Risk and Clue, and I played so much Monopoly. If I never see Monopoly again, it would be too
For
soon.
sure.
Right, like it's 1981 and 1982. Game of Life was all the rage. We had, I don't know if you remember, you can probably still get it, but you get the box that says 101 board games. And there's like three games in there, and 97 that are just hot trash that are there as filler. So my sister and I would play Parcheesi and Chinese checkers. And I mean, I grew up playing chess and all that sort of stuff. I don't think I still play anything. I'm looking around the bunker here. I don't think I still play anything from my childhood. But I have exceptionally fond memories of, it's minus 40 Celsius, which is certainly it's minus 40 Fahrenheit, and just bombing through 12 hours of board games because you can't go outside, and it's something that
Right.
became part of my formative life. It's interesting. So in your, I guess, you came to St. Louis and you're already a gamer, and then the late 90s hit, and modern board gaming goes boom. So can I ask, what were you studying in St. Louis? Because I'm sure it wasn't board game design.
It was not board game design. No, I have no formal training in board game design. I feel like I'm still going through the training in board game design every day. I came to St. Louis specifically to study international business with a focus in Japanese. So I
Wow,
thought that I
okay.
was going to move to Japan and live there and work in business somehow in Japan. I did end up studying abroad in Japan, but that after that I was like, that's what I wanted for my Japanese training, and I want to do other things now.
So the Jamie Stegmeier that almost was a businessman in Japan.
Right,
How
exactly.
close did the world come to that alternate reality?
I wouldn't say, I guess a little close, but I one of the best years of my life was when I studied abroad in Japan. But really, I was there for maybe 8 or 9 months, studying abroad my junior year, and that was, I don't, I after that, I was like, that's what I wanted. And I actually revisited Japan just this last year and had a wonderful time revisiting it. And I'm glad that I have that language ability and can return and have fun there and enjoy the culture, be respectful to a different culture. But I like the path that I took, the different path. Yeah.
And
Did you
so,
study abroad or did you?
no,
Yeah.
I'm a chef by trade. I also have a master's in business, so I've been working in high-level hospitality most of my career. And so I have a number of wonderful pieces of paper, but I'm a chef, I'm a pastry chef, I'm a qualified butcher, and I have a master's in business. And so I work in high-level hospitality, and I love it. One of the questions I'd hope to get to, which I might segue to now, because I know I want to be respectful of your time, but I work in a creative space. Right. And I have been creating dishes and dining experiences. I get out of bed every day to make people happy with food. Right. And it's something that
Love that.
I adore. Right. And I look at your business model, and I actually talked about it a few episodes ago, what I call the Stonemaier FOMO model, which is very different to the FOMO model that's out in the world, in that you tend to bring games right to the finish line and go, hey, by the way, guys, boom, it's coming in 2 weeks, which I adore. Because we go, wow, here's a new game, and it's in our hands while that crush of, oh, it looks so great, is all fresh, right? It's a wonderful thing as a gamer. Now, I do crazy stuff, like I make my own hams and bacons, and I have catered for some of the most amazing, let's say amazing. I did Bill Gates' personal Christmas party 1 year when I was 24, right? Like I've had the kind of
So
experiences,
cool.
wild, not bragging, I'm just saying I've had some wild experiences. I don't know how to not share those with people, right? So I guess my question you know, I obviously we had a walk through the old video, the Cabinet of Curiosities. How do you reconcile your thrill for something you've created with the absolute absence of being able to share it and just explode with the, do you know what I'm saying? Like it's,
yeah.
I look at that and I go, I've done something amazing. I've got something amazing in the tank. I want everybody to know. How do you keep that genie in the bottle? And I don't mean practically, I mean emotionally and personally, because that's going to be tough.
It is tough. And it is tougher for some games more than others as well. And I'm excited about all of our different games, but they, like with Vantage, one of my recent launches and releases, I did end up talking about it in advance.
Yeah.
Just because I had so much to say about it. Whereas many games, there aren't as many stories to tell about some games, and that isn't a knock on those games at all. Like Origin Story. Origin Story is one that I didn't announce until right before we launched it and shipped it. That one had a much quicker design cycle than Vantage did. I still love that game, and I love teaching that game.
Can I be honest? I love that game. I love Trick Takers. I grew up in a bridge household. I think Origin Story is wild in that I think you almost, in your first, at least in our experience, first thing it was, you win by mistake. But the journey is fantastic. You know, because you flip an event and you go, what do you mean we're switching bodies? You know, so I absolutely take your point, but it's been a hit in our game group. So
I'm glad to hear that.
But again,
Well, part of it is that I try my best. One of the reasons that I do this method is I really try to shine a big spotlight on especially our games, but also our expansions for a while, a prolonged spotlight. And I think that is one of the reasons why I'm able to hold back my excitement for something that I know is coming because I really want to shine that spotlight and share my excitement for the thing that's already here and for a while. So even though I know our entire 2026 schedule, I know all of that, but right now I'm excited to talk about Origin Story. I'm excited to talk about, you know, the Tokaido expansion, things like that we have right now and that people are actually playing right now. So I think that's one of the big reasons I'm able to hold back a little bit on that excitement.
I think it's remarkable that we don't see Stonemaier leaks, right? We don't see, we see leaks from other games. We see leaks from Ion. We see leaks from Garfield. We see leaks from, you know, it's natural for people to want to talk about it. How do you, I guess, inspire that same circle of the family with your team to say, guys, you know, like I guess for me, as I said, working in a creative space, it's always about that effusive sharing. And I'm, you know, you're surrounded by professionals, you work with a lot of people, you do a lot of playtesting, you'd be doing a year of playtesting with something, yet we don't somehow ever, and I know NDAs are a wonderful thing, but they're also, legally, they're very hard to enforce. So you kind of have to get people on board with the idea of the reveal. How do you share that effusive, I guess, enthusiasm for keeping the secret? What's your secret to keeping the secret, I guess, if there is one?
No, honestly, I think part of the secret is that we don't do NDAs. I ask our playtesters not to talk about it, but I trust them with that rather than boiling that trust down to a document. And I know there are circumstances, probably in your career, like the Bill Gates dinner, there may have been an NDA involved there. I understand that. But yeah, I put a lot of trust in our playtesters, and I am kind of amazed because our playtesters, I work with our lead playtesters, but they have different groups of people that they're pulling from, various people who may or may not have much of a connection at all to Stonemaier Games.
Sure.
And even those people are pretty quiet about this. So I would say while things have been leaked, probably 75% of them were me making a mistake and accidentally like showing the back of the box or opening that closet behind me or things like that. Very, very few have come from anyone who wasn't meant to say something, like a localization partner or a playtester, things like that. Usually it's me that makes that mistake.
I love that you don't use NDAs because there's a business, I guess, sort of mantra and belief that trust leads to trust, you know, and starting in a position of an absence of trust leads to a working relationship where that trust is always in question. And I love that. It's something that I would have never sort of seen coming in a business as robust as yours. So thank you. That's fantastic. You are among the most transparent and accessible designers and distributors. You know, you do regular, I'm never up early enough to catch your live streams, but I often watch them on replay. You have regular little vignettes that you pop on your YouTube channel. I guess, why is that important to you? Why is that important to Jamie Stegmaier? Because it clearly is. It's something that you do, and you do with enthusiasm, and you do, you have a real openness and transparency. And again, that accessibility. I sent you an email saying, hey, Jamie, I'd love to chat. And you came back and said, absolutely. Here's the time. I mean, it was wonderful. How important is that to you? And I guess, why is it important? Where does that come from in your, you know, your makeup? Where does that come from?
Right. I think my overall ethos is actually comes back to trust. You mentioned trust a few seconds ago, that if I can be transparent about as much as possible, and I enjoy doing that, I enjoy processing things in words out loud and in writing. If I can do that a lot, that if somewhere on the vast, you know, vast world of the internet, someone hears something about me that they wonder about me or Stonemaier Games, any of our games, that, that maybe put some of that trust in doubt, that because of the amount of transparency over the years that I've tried to provide, that maybe they know that they can trust what I'm saying and or find the answer based somewhere in the world of content that I've created. That isn't the motivation for why I do it. I do it because it just feels normal and right, but that is maybe one of the symptoms behind it, that transparency hopefully leads to more trust than than if I kept things really close to my chest.
Amazing. I love that. I want to circle back to your origin story, because we got kind of segued at the St. Louis studying. Yeah, yeah. At what point in your studies and, you know, going to Japan and studying business, did you go, actually, I want to go make toys? And I know that's distilling it down, but, you know, I want to go make games. I want to go. At what point did you go, I actually think I've got something here?
Yeah, I had two jobs after college, both around 3 to 4 years. One was as a project manager for a textbook company, and one was managing a small staff at a facility on campus here in St. Louis at a university here. And it was during that second job that Kickstarter became a thing, and I was fascinated by this idea that I could potentially connect directly one-on-one with customers, with people who were excited about a thing that I was making. And I had designed games my entire life just for fun. And so I started to see games show up on Kickstarter, and I was like, okay, maybe I can make a game and put it on Kickstarter and have these two things intermingle. At that point in time, I was not expecting it to be like a career or anything more than that. I wanted to put a game on Kickstarter and see how it did. That was Viticulture in 2012. And then it wasn't until Euphoria the next year that did really well. And then we delivered Euphoria to backers. And that was when, in 2014, that's when I said, okay, I have enough money to saved up now that I could do this for a year and see if it works out. Let me see if I can try to make this more than just a hobby, basically.
Yeah, it's clearly worked out for you.
That
segues really nicely into my next question. We're obviously a board gamer house. My daughters are now 17 and 19, but like you, in their formative years, they were writing and making board games, right? So I still have on my shelf, I still have Turtle King, which is my middle daughter's greatest triumph, deluxified with little Fimo turtles and everything. And my eldest daughter, she made games all through her teen years and whatever else. So looking back on the games you made for fun, what's the one you look back on and go, that's the one I missed the most, or the one that got away, or a game you made for fun that maybe won't make it to mass market, but it's your favorite baby, or the one you enjoyed making the most from the games that never were pre-Stonemaier?
Right. Pre-Stonemaier?
Yeah.
So a lot of the games that I made as a kid,
it might be trash, Jamie. Like it might be, you might look at it now and it's hot trash, but it's right. For you, it's warm and in your heart. And you go, I love playing that with my friends. You might've been in grade 7. I don't know. But I'm just like, what's the moment that you went, I'm making a game, and you played it with your friends, whatever it is. Do you have one that sticks out more than others?
There's one. So a lot of my games back then were like, I would play Monopoly and then I would make my version of Monopoly. Or sure. I mentioned Scotland Yard. I made my own version of Scotland Yard. And I had a lot of fun. That one comes to mind a little bit, because I had a lot of fun drawing the map and figuring out what the map with the board looked like for that game. I didn't. And so that's probably my best answer to that question back then.
Sure.
I don't think any of those were even close to being worth publishing, but I have fond memories of creating it, I guess, the creative process.
My eldest daughter created a game in grade 6 called Pocket PvP, and the rules changed every 15 minutes depending on whether she was winning or not. But we still laugh and have fun and talk about how great a family experience it was. So that's beautiful. I'm going to pay you a compliment, so just bear with me. You're an effusively positive person, right? You know, in your content and the way you present, you regularly release little shorts, audio shorts on YouTube about a game you've played, and you always choose to talk about your favorite mechanism rather than, and I'm sure there's things about a game you go, oh God, but you always pluck out the positive. And now I'm imagining that is just Jamie Stigmar. That's who you are. Would that be about right? Is that you're generally positive output? That's
feel
not the
most
question.
myself when I'm positive. Yeah.
Great. How does that affect your design choices? And does it make it harder for you to be a self-critic? Or does it make it easier to be a self-critic because you can see the positive very clearly? Does that question make sense?
It does make sense.
Awesome.
I would say that I'm very critical of myself, both the things that I've made and have published, and also the things that I am currently making and trying to perhaps publish. So the positivity that I have for other people and the things that I share, that is, I think, what I want to put out there to the world. I want to share joy. I want to share good feelings with the world. But I don't think that stops me or impedes me. And in some ways, I think it helps me be spend more critical energy on myself.
Do you think it kind of splits your brain in both ways? So your positivity shifts outwards, and not negativity, but sort of the more critical eye is shifted inwards. Does
That's a great way to put it.
that mean that you might potentially be more overly critical than most of your own work, your own worst critic?
I think I'm my own worst critic. I mean, it's one of those, and I'm sure maybe you can relate to this too, but when I read like a comment on the internet that is negative and is negative for a reason that resonates with me about something that I've created, like I think about that a lot more than the positive comments.
Sure. Yeah.
Perhaps that's just, the nature of the internet, but it really does. Like when one of those things resonates with me, I'm like, they're right. This person is right. They didn't say it in a very nice way, but they are right. And I'm digging into this and I want to figure out how to do better next time or how to, yeah.
Yeah. And does that skin, or I guess that veneer include things that are already published? You look back and go, I wish I could have done that differently, or at what point do you go, no, that game is great and I can high five myself with that? Or do you never get to a point where you're high fiving? You're always, because I as a creative, I look at it every time I cook something, I go, that could be better. And I have made some whiz bang stuff, but every time I look at it, I go, that could be better. And don't get me wrong, my middle daughter is my worst critic. I could be as hard as I like. My middle daughter is my worst critic. So I guess, do you celebrate and high five and look at some of your things and go, that is perfect? Or can you still see things in hindsight? You go, I wish I'd done a version two, or I wish, because that's hard. That's hard as a creative to, it's the perfectionist syndrome of, well, I'm never quite satisfied. It's not really a question, I
It
guess, more of a
certainly,
statement. And I see you nodding. It's not really a question, and I feel that very much. What would you like if I said, what would you like to see? What would you like to see from us? The gamers, the
from you.
consumers, from us. If I said, Jamie, what would you like to see from us? What can we do or be? Because, and I don't want to dwell on, you touched very lightly and very politely on internet toxicity, because it's a very hard thing, particularly, and you're very transparent with why you've stepped away from crowdfunding in the past. I think I crowdfund a lot, but I get quite emotional when I see people post things that are really quite awful, or demanding, because these are people that, like yourself, that are, they're making something that's important to them, and they're getting eviscerated by somebody who's got to wait an extra 3 weeks, for example. So that aside, because I'd love to flip a switch and go, well, the internet's now not a toxic place, but from the gamers, from the consumers, from the people that are, is there something that you'd like to see from us? I don't know, maybe there's no answer to that. It's just I'm curious.
Well, It is a tough question because for the most, like, I see it as my job to serve you. And you touched upon the internet part of it. That was certainly probably my answer if you hadn't preempted that. I would say, and this isn't a request of anyone, but I would say that I really enjoy seeing little bursts of creativity for people around games that they love. So, and this is bled into Stonemaier Games. So, like, it's going to seem promotional, but this I
No,
say this
no, no. I know
genuinely.
what you're going to say. You're going to talk about the fan art, for example.
Well, the fan art, and with the most recent, we have the completely new bird cards that were designed by fans, not illustrated by them, but the new card designs that were created by them. And for people created these just because they wanted to, just for fun. There was no prospect of them being published. We ended up doing this somewhat unexpectedly, but I love seeing that creativity. Even the 6-year-old Wingspan fan who designs a card for their favorite bird and they sketch it out and their mom posts it on our Facebook group. I love seeing that. And so if anything, I would just maybe encourage people to do a little bit of that every now and then. Design a card for your favorite game and share it with a
Nice.
creator and share it in their Facebook group. That means a lot to us as creators. Is there any comparison to that to the food world? When
Oh,
someone
for
does anyone
sure.
ever try to like recreate a dish that you made and that makes you happy? Or yeah.
So, not in recreating, but people are terrified to cook for chefs. You know, particularly if you're a chef that's done like 1% or stuff, and you come to their house for dinner and they're sweating bullets. And I'm like, you know, we love being cooked for. I don't care if it's mac and cheese. I don't care. You've cooked something for me. You've put an effort in for me. And so I absolutely hear what you're saying. So similar question to that. If you could, you know, genie appears and you get one wish for the industry, right? For this amazing hobby that we have. You know, and I don't want to talk about tariffs. I don't want to talk about but one way, because obviously, you know, you're going through probably the hardest, I imagine, one of the hardest years that you've probably experienced. I'm guessing just from the outside. And I don't want to bog down in that because there's news about that. There's all kinds of stuff going on. But if you could make one wish for our beautiful hobby, you know, and this selfish wish, this is for Jamie Stegmaier. What would that selfish wish be? Or what would that wish be that you wish? I mean, for the hobby. I mean, within reality, my wish would be unlimited time to play games. But I mean, like something that could actually, you
Well,
know, something that could
that's
actually.
actually very close to my answer. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
The answer that came. So for me, time is my most precious resource, and I would wish everyone more time. I
Yeah.
mean, like if everyone had an extra, actually, I would tie that more time. And I've heard more and more, especially after the pandemic, of people who maybe their gaming group dispersed as a result of the pandemic and never
Sure.
quite recongealed. They haven't found that new group. So
Yeah.
a wish for time and a wish for people to find their gaming group, their group that they
Amazing.
really connect with, whether it's family or friends, whatever it may be. I'll combine those two wishes if you allow
I will allow it. I will absolutely allow it.
it.
So I guess one of my final questions, and thank you, you've been very generous of your time. Is there an end game condition for Jamie Stegmaier? How do you know that you've won, right? I'm not talking about Stonemaier Games and wrapping up the business, but how do you know that you have won, whatever you want to bundle winning up looks like? Is there an end game condition? What does that look like? And how will you know that you've won?
You know, I used to think that the answer to that question, maybe not winning exactly, but the end game was when I saved up enough money that I don't have to work anymore. That answer has very much changed since I started this career in gaming because I really love my job. I love the variety of my job. I love my coworkers. I am incredibly fortunate to be in a position where I love what I do every day. I feel like I've already won in a way that I have the thing
Amazing.
that I want, and I try to enjoy it and not take it for granted, and hopefully continue to bring joy to tabletops as you do as well. We bring joy in different ways. So that I may be in the end right now, but I hope that end goes on for many, many years to
With
come.
expansions. Life
With
expansions.
expansions, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I have one more for you, and it's a variant of a question that we sit around us. So as chefs at the end of the night, if we've had a couple of wines, we sit around and we play a game called Last Meal. What would your last meal be? So imagine, I don't want to make it dark. We don't ever want to make it about, well, you're dying or whatever the case is. But tonight at midnight, Thanos is snapping his fingers and all the board games are disappearing. What would your last board game be? You've got today to play one. It doesn't have to be, it's interesting. It's not often your favorite game, but what's the last board game experience you want to have? Because tonight they're gone.
Oh, I love that question. You've asked multiple questions today that I've never been asked on these many chats that I've had. So I appreciate you being so good at asking these questions. That is really tough. Because I think I would love for it to be a gaming evening. If I could have like one last gaming evening and play a couple different types of games, I'd probably want to play a large group cooperative game. I love Blob Party. I love Caution Signs. I love So Clover Just One. Like that's, I would want to play one of those. That makes me feel really connected to the people that I'm with. I'd probably want to play a game that we published, not necessarily one that I designed, but one that I'm proud of putting on the table. I'd probably want to play one of those. And then I'd also probably throw favorite of like a game that I've enjoyed many, many times and want to play many, many more times over. Like just the other day, I had a real hankering to play Dune Imperium.
Great game.
I love Dune Imperium. So I got that to the table. So I'll throw that one in there. Maybe that would be the one. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Jamie, that's all I have for you. As I said, thank you for your time. I am filled with gratitude that you set this time aside. I know my listeners are going to really enjoy what you've shared today. And I hope that whatever you're doing with the rest of your day and your week, that you somehow fill your cup.
Well, thank you.
My thanks. And I look forward to whatever you do next.
I love that. Thank you so much. And yeah, and thanks to anyone who's listening along.
All right. Appreciate it. You have a great day. Thanks, Jamie. Bye.
You too.
And that'll do it for this week's show. Thank you for your time. You can reach me on all the socials. Find me on Facebook by searching One Man Clapping. You can email me at wonmanclapping, as in I won all the games, at gmail.com. You can join the One Man Clapping Guild on BGG and subscribe to Guild 4426. You can help OMC by dropping me a like on Facebook or Instagram, or by leaving a review on whatever platform you choose. If it's a bad review, I won't cry for long. I'm a big girl. Thank you as always for your time. Your time is precious, and the fact that you chose to waste an hour of it listening to how I spend my time is always humbling. Until next time, get your game on, even if you've got to play with yourself. 20 Strong just delivered, and I'm going to be playing with myself 3 or 4 times a day for the rest of the week. This week's episode has been brought to you by Speed Paints. They're speedy, they do a great job. My minis are still unbloody painted. Peace out, mofos.